Well, I first want to say I'm very happy to have been invited to speak here in Hayward. I have spoken here a couple of times, but the last one was when Joy Atkinson was the interim minister. And also years ago when Mark Bellatini was the minister. My message this morning will be addressing, advocating for actually, dreams as a way of translating or transcending the compliance which seems to be so much a part of our everyday life. But I have to say that in a way I feel uneasy, awkward talking about dreams when so much tragedy has happened so recently. But even so, I still believe in dreams, and I still want to stand up for them and stand up for bringing your dreams into reality. So I also will be talking a little bit about traveling, since this is the season for travel, because in my dream, two of my dreams actually intersected. One was dancing, and one was dancing in Tuscany. So let me begin with the story. So I'm driving through the Chianti Giana. That's the primary road through the Chianti wine country in Tuscany. It's something like the road through the Napa Valley, with wineries on each side, vineyards on each side. It's narrow, one lane in each direction, so like that. And the traffic slows through each of a series of small towns, but then speeds up in between them. And so I'm on my way home from a successful, though nerve-wracking, journey. I found the place that Marco, my maestro di ballo, my master of dance, has told me about and recommended for buying ballroom dance shoes. It's a hole in the wall, really. It's out by the airport in the fringes of Florence. And I'm feeling pretty pleased with myself because for having this courage to set out on this quest for ballroom dance shoes completely alone in completely unfamiliar territory. Only after I'm skimming the Chianti hills patterned with vineyards and olive groves does it come to me with an energy almost sexual. I relish this time alone. I crave it. And I hear myself sing to myself an exultant almost hymn. My life is my own, all this. Suddenly I stab on the brake with my right foot, simultaneously stabbing for the clutch with my left foot to avoid stalling. A horse, a tall sorrel, is trotting down the highway with saddle, without rider. He's traveling the same direction as I am, but on my left in the opposing lane, heading into potential oncoming traffic. And on my right, in the grassy edge of off the road, the rider is running after his horse. He's a colorful young man in a bright red shirt with a jaunty feather in his Robin Hood style hat. And he's running and calling, but his horse shows no sign of heeding. In fact, what was previously a trot has turned into a gallop as the prankster turns a piebald eye toward the panting owner. The young man is puffing and puffing, galloping himself, then slowing to a walk, then galloping again. So luckily, no oncoming traffic has made its appearance, but it can't be long before a feisty Peugeot comes racing around the bend. The traffic in my lane in accommodation has slowed to a snail's pace. Still, it's moving faster than the young man, though not as fast as his runaway mount, who has now vanished around a curve up ahead. I pass the young man, And clearly, he isn't going to catch his horse on foot. Having been forced to a walk, running, forced to a walk, heaving. This is an extremely dangerous situation. The Italians, they don't seem invested in the plight of the horse or of the frantic young man. His cheeks red with exertion, black hair soaked, creeping out from under the hat. And so the shy straniera in me, foreigner is a stranger, straniera in me, with little command of the Italian language, taught never to give a strange man a ride in my own country, surprises herself. In my concern over the plight of the horse and the rider, I lose myself, my timid self, and a stronger self emerges, who, without self-conscious thought, simply acts. I pull over, and as the young man comes up alongside the car, I offer him a ride. He gladly accepts. Muy peligroso. My years of Spanish automatically click in. Yes, very dangerous, he concurs, knowing some English and some Spanish, as many Italians do. We round another bend, and there up ahead is the horse galloping toward his friends, the young man says. The horse goes to his friends, and after a pause, not sure I've understand, he offers in a way of explanation, his friends, the horses. Ahead also are the young man's friends who are on horseback, apparently members of the same riding group. One has hold of the bridle of the runaway horse. We drive up and the young man jumps out in his excitement, barely taking time to say thank you. He grabs hold of the reins. And as I leave him behind, I see him in the rear view mirror, one foot raised toward the stirrup, preparing to mount. Stepping into the unknown takes courage, a kind of courage I rarely muster here in the United States. In Italy, I'm challenged to call it forth again and again. It's a courage that sets me free, but not only to dream, but to bring my dreams into reality. So today I'm talking about traveling, and I'm talking about dreaming, and how through traveling, two of my dreams have interlocked in a magical way, dancing and Tuscany. So I'm standing up for dreams and for the endeavor to pull the land of dreams into the land of Earth. It's a struggle, and it requires the hand of grace to bring a dream into reality. I want to tell you my story, and I hope that you will find in it an affirmation of your own dreams and of the desire to bring them into reality and the courage to try. Dream one, Dancing with the Stars. How many of you have watched that program, Dancing with? Okay. Well, an early year when that program had begun, I saw Jane Seymour, who most people don't remember, but anyway, she used to be television's Dr. Quinn, medicine woman. And she was on Dancing with the Stars, and she was reporting, I always wanted to be a dancer. A contestant on Dancing with the Stars, she said, I had always wanted to dance, and now she, in her 50s, finally had a chance. She said, it's never too late. So my dream goes back to childhood when I was studying ballet. I wanted to be a ballerina like Maria Tallchief. A little later, inspired by the old Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies, I dreamed of ballroom dancing with a romantic partner. I quit ballet when I was a teen to make room for boys. And I let go of the dream of doing everything a man can do, but backward in high heels, as Ginger was reported to do. For all the good reasons I let go of that, you can imagine them: marriage, divorce, career, the serious stuff. So occasionally I went out social dancing, Then dancing disappeared from my life completely. My dream resurfaced in my early 40s when a fellow graduate student at Stark King asked me to go along with her to a ballroom dance class followed by a tea dance. She didn't feel comfortable going by herself. Well, the ballroom dance teacher was a bit seedy with unkempt hair and salt and pepper beard. He greeted us and told us the class would be an American tango. As the lesson got underway, he called on me, a beginner, to help demonstrate the basic figures. Well, I was incredibly complimented and a bit scared, but I managed to follow him through the figures. My ballet training helped. Afterwards, he asked me if I had taken tango lessons before. When I answered no, he seemed surprised and went on to say that I must be a natural dancer. Well, right then, that long buried dream, that seed, showed signs of life that later developed into a full-fledged determination to realize my dancing dream, not knowing if I ever could sufficiently. Dream number two, Tuscany. My passion for dancing coincides with another passion, Italy, and more particularly, Tuscany. On a Sunday afternoon, I was watching a travel show on PBS. The host, and I never remember his name, do you know the travel host on TV? Steve? Rick Steves. Okay, I always want to call him Steve Ricks or something like that. On a Sunday afternoon, I was watching a travel show, and the host was walking the Cinque Terre in Italy, high above the Ligurian Sea. The rugged path, the blue of the sea, and the astounding beauty of those five ancient towns interspersed along the way, rising up from the blue, totally captivated me. I want to walk the Cinque Terre, I said to myself. The desire to walk the Cinque Terre grew into determination to go to Italy, something that in the past I would simply have let slip by me, bracketed as unrealistic, too much trouble, too expensive. Less than a year later, I was spending several weeks in a small Tuscan town that no one had ever heard of and still hasn't, Brenna. It's on the river Merce, south of Siena. It was one of the most beautiful periods I've ever spent with my parents, whom I talked into going with me. I've rarely seen my mother so happy. She loved the place, the house, the terrace, the little town with only one street, a tiny cave of a grocery store, and a single tremendously popular pizzeria that served marvelous mussels and trout. And yes, I did see the Cinque Terre. I didn't have the hike I hoped for, but we three, my parents and I, took a rocking boat ride from Lerici, which is south of the Cinque Terre, along the coast to Monterosso, the northernmost town of the Cinque Terre. I learned I could do it. I could, with intention, fulfill a dream. Only 3 years later, my mother died suddenly of a massive bleed. The time I had with her and with my father in Tuscany turned out to be a special gift, a fulfillment by the powers that be of a very beautiful dream. I've always been a dreamer, but I haven't always had the courage of my convictions. I have another side, the stronger of the two, for most of my life. It's the inner voice that says, you're selfish. It's a voice that society has largely adopted. A pragmatic voice that says, you have to compromise your dreams. A judgmental voice that says, hard work is what it's all about. And a moral voice, think about others, not yourself. The prevalence and power of the accusing voice that says you're selfish was brought home to me by my students at St. Mary's College, a class of working adults who had enrolled in an interdisciplinary master's degree program in the humanities at St. Mary's. The introductory course is called It's About Time. I ask the students to introduce themselves by describing what time means to them or what their experience of time is like. So in one group of 20 students, 17, including every woman, 17 of the 20, including every woman, use the word selfish to introduce themselves. They all felt selfish taking time for themselves, in particular in enrolling in this course of study, which is oriented toward personal enrichment rather than job enhancement. I feel selfish because it's for me, they repeatedly said in one way or another. So my mother might have been among this group of women, as I am. I've incorporated the voice that says, you're selfish, and I carry the indictment within me. The voice of pragmatism sounds like my father. Jeannie, you have to compromise. When he was a young man with a wife and child, he felt he had to compromise his dream of being a fine artist in order to make a living, and so he focused on commercial art. Hence his admonition to me, you have to compromise. He returned to serious painting only after he retired at the age of 70. And no doubt, you know, there is truth in the message of compromise. It is certainly a voice I have incorporated, which has informed much of my life. But I think we're too quick to compromise the values that make life worthwhile for the values of the marketplace. Again, my students have made clear to me how much this kind of compromise demoralizes them. Many of them are financially successful. They've accessed the material goods that they so much wanted. But in this course, where they read the autobiographies of persons who have made significant life choices that have impacted society, people like Gandhi, Wiesel, Dorothy Day, Helen Prejean, an underlying longing often surfaces in these students, what one might call of a spiritual nature. They often complain that they don't have time for the things that matter: family, leisure, nature, contemplation, the good of society. They complain that despite material acquisitions, they still don't feel fulfilled. They want something more. The more is often voiced as to the desire to make a difference, to do something for the poor, to write creatively, to smell the flowers. I believe this is a way of saying that they have compromised their hopes and dreams. And the course provides a context in which their hopes and dreams are being reawakened. So I'm glad my father returned to painting, but I hope it doesn't have to take us some 50 years to begin to realize our dreams. The British psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott, whose distinctive contribution to the understanding of human development is based on his work as a pediatrician, validates the dreamer side of me. In his work, Playing in Reality, it's now a work of classic work of reference, he examines what in a child's early development opens the way to creative living throughout life. What in a child's early development opens the way to creative living throughout life? He writes, "It is creative apperception. It is creative apperception more than anything else that makes the individual feel that life is worth living. Contrasted with this is a relationship to external reality, which is one of compliance. The world and its details being recognized, but only as something to be fitted in with or demanding adaptation. Compliance," he says, "carries with it a sense of futility for the individual and is associated with the idea that nothing matters and that life is not worth living. In a tantalizing way, many individuals, he goes on to say, have experienced just enough of creative living to recognize that for most of their time they are living uncreatively, as if caught up in the creativity of someone else or of a machine. The voices that say, you're selfish, you have to compromise, are the interjected voices of compliance. The voices that say, listen to your dreams, follow your dreams, you can make your dreams come true, are the voices of what Winnicott calls universal creativity. The creativity that belongs to being alive, a creativity that belongs to all of us. It enables us to experience life as satisfying and meaningful rather than bound by the laws of compliance to a life of dissatisfaction, leading to pent-up anger and loss of meaning. Creativity, he says, is a force over against the power of compliance. In a world confusing, conflicted, and frightening, in which our American dream sometimes seems threatened, I am still standing up for dreams, for following your dreams, large or small, for the desire to realize your dreams, and the courage to try. And I'm not alone. Take heart from Winnicott, or Maslow, or Hesse, or Campbell, or Roosevelt, or even Oprah. It was hard for me to muster the courage to travel, but through travel, my two dreams intersected fortuitously, Tuscany and dancing. I originally had the idea of writing these words that I'm sharing with you today. Sitting in a stone farmhouse, which used to be the house for the sheep, in a medieval borgo above Greve in Chianti, the setting sun turning pine trees rust gold. My dream number one. And in Tuscany, I found my maestro di ballo, Marco, my master of dance, who awakened in me the technique and the freedom to really dance the way I always imagined I could. It's never too late, my dream number two. So when our dream is slipping away and we're doing everything in our power to recapture it, how foolish we can look to the outside world. Take, for instance, that young man, puffing, running on foot down the highway, seeing the distance between him and his horse grow. I don't know the real story behind the horse that almost got away, but I believe that young man was following his dream, much as I am, much as we all are, a dream that almost got away.